This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. Win, lose or draw, McDelivery will always help bring home the 3 points. And speaking of points, order now on the McDonald's app and you'll earn reward points through every delivery. Order today, rewards tomorrow. You in? Only via app at participating restaurants, 18+, rewards registration required. Points only on menu items, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com. Today's guest is the creator of the hit BBC drama, Peaky Blinders.
The impetus for doing Peaky was stories that my mum and dad told me when I was a kid. What I don't want to do is, isn't it a shame for these poor working class people? You know, didn't they have a terrible time? Wasn't it awful? So that, you know, the drinking and fighting and all that stuff, it's glamorous stuff. I just thought, this is in Brum, you know, this is absolutely part of Birmingham history that never gets told. That is a drama. It's like a Western. Yeah, I've been a blues fan since I was born. My parents were blues fans. All grandparents were blues fans. It strikes me that we got lucky. These new owners mean it. Doing the right thing about the city, about Birmingham. It's like an engine that starts to work within the club and the community where everybody starts bouncing off each other. And if you can get that right, that's the thing that's going to lift us up to where we all know we should be.
Wayne Rooney has been sacked by Birmingham City.
I think it was a brave decision to act quickly. I just didn't think that it was a fit. Whereas Mowbray, you know, he's funny and is aware of the absurdity of life, which is what blues fans are as well. He understands football fans who are not fans of a club like Liverpool or Man City. Fans of a club like us are there for reasons that defy logic.
Hello and welcome back to the Blues Focus podcast with today's very special guest. As usual, I'm happy to be joined by Jamie Lawler.
You're right.
Zach Woods.
Hello, everybody.
And Sam Sheppey.
Hi, guys. No camera, but still here in voice.
Today's guest is the creator of the hit BBC drama Peaky Blinders, set in the hard-working city of Birmingham from 1919 to 1933. The show is easily one of the most stylish and iconic of TV programmes, starring multiple Hollywood celebrities in Cillian Murphy, Tom Hardy and Adrian Brody, to mention a few. In 2020, he was awarded a CBE for his services to drama and entertainment and the wider work in the Birmingham community. A CBE, a screenwriter, film producer and director, but most importantly, he's a big blues fan. Please welcome Stephen Knight.
Hello, good to be here.
It's very good to have you on. It's absolutely delighted to have you on. But yeah, this podcast has been a few months in the making. We first met back in August before the first home game of the season against Leeds in the Roost in the pub. Obviously, what an amazing day that turned out to be. It was just buzzing before the game even got kicked off with Tom Brady, the fireworks, all the tributes to Trevor Francis as well, which was very touching. But since then, it obviously has been a bit of a bumpy ride. But taking you back to that day, I mean, what's your best memories of that day, really?
It was just amazing. I mean, you know, I think like a lot of Blues fans, things started to happen on that day that we never thought would ever happen. Like, Tom Brady's not going to walk into the Roost. You know, not ever. That's just not going to happen. And it did. But I mean, there was an occasion before that in Baines's where I think it was the last game of the previous season where Tom Wagner and his people arrived. Tom Wagner came up to the bar and he was heaving because it was the last game. And he put his car behind the bar and said, buy everybody a drink. And the barmaid thought he meant everybody who just walked in with him.
Mm.
Said, no, 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 it means everybody in the pub. She said, I don't know how to do that. It was so, so brilliant. And then on that day in the Roost, when they all show up, and in advance of that, I thought I'd better get a drink in for them. And I foolishly bought, I mean, there wasn't a great deal of choice. So I got them all, I think I got about 20 Budweisers. And when they got there, they're like, what's this? We want Guinness.
Oh, no.
And Guinness. So I think this is part of Tom's, you know, health and nutrition.
Yes.
I mean, it's all so exciting at the moment. I mean, just small stories like that show the difference between previous owners we've had and these guys that have come in. I mean, what are your thoughts, just everything going on off the pitch? Because, I mean, even small details, we've had the stands now renovated, but even like fresh licks of paint, renovated changing rooms. I mean, how fantastic a job are the new owners doing?
It's brilliant. And, you know, I was sort of privy to conversations in advance of the whole thing happening. And I thought, this isn't going to happen. Something's going to go wrong. It's Blues, you know. It's never going to work. And the Chinese owners were, I mean, some of the stories which I sadly can't share about the sort of labyrinthine negotiations that went on with the previous owners and the madness and the hilarious things that were happening, which, you know, I think the Americans just dealt with because they're used to this sort of stuff. You know, they do deal in distressed assets, and God knows we were a distressed asset. And they dealt with it. They had patience and they had fortitude and got it done. And then when it actually happened, you just thought, you know, I've been a Blues fan since I was born because if my parents were Blues fans, all grandparents were Blues fans, and probably their parents were Blues fans. I don't know. So there was nothing I could do about it. And my kids are all Blues fans as well now. But the idea that the thing that we've always thought can't happen might happen is so bewildering at first. You just think, oh my God, this can happen. And then, of course, we do the Blues thing.
Exactly, yeah.
Just all up immediately. It's like, oh no, this is going too well. Now, I think we've got somebody who, it seems to me there's an unusual, I mean, I read Small Heath Alliance a lot and I've never known a consensus like that on Small Heath Alliance because everybody, you know, everybody's got their own opinion and stuff. And by the way, Small Heath Alliance is brilliant and I think it's hilarious. On occasions it's just inspired humour and stuff. But to see the consensus around Tony Mowbray is really great.
So I suppose, Stephen, my next question is, obviously, you're in and around the club a little bit, like you said. So have you met any of the players? And with that, do you have a favourite?
I don't get to meet the players much. They're all so young. You know, they're younger than my kids. And it's quite strange. And I've found this for years because I usually go to the Jasper Carrot Suite and you get the man of the match. And like when we've lost 4-0 and the poor man of the match gets dragged in, you think, oh, you poor sod. But, you know, it's like when the horse, Jeff Horsfield, used to come in and he was like a skinny kid. Whereas on the pitch, he looks like this great big lumbering bloke. It's very different. So the players, in fact, I did meet him when I invited a lot of the players to the Peaky Ballet thing in Birmingham. And, you know, they're great, a real laugh. And I don't know what the current thoughts are on Craig Gardner, but he's a brilliant bloke. And the people that I meet behind the scenes are fantastic. And previously, I've always given them a Peaky hat, but I stopped doing that because it kept going wrong. So I've been talking to a lot of people around, you know, behind the scenes. And it strikes me that we've got lucky in that these new owners mean it.
Yeah.
In terms of doing the right thing about the city, about Birmingham, about the community, Small Heath, Bordesley and all of that. Not least because I think they understand that doing the right thing is actually profitable.
You know, 100%.
It's not like, let's be nice. Well, it is being nice, but being nice also creates that mood and that atmosphere. And it's like an engine that starts to work within within the club and the community where everybody starts bouncing off each other. And if you can get that right, that's the thing that's going to lift us up to where we all know we should be as the club that carries the name of the second biggest city in Britain. That's where we should be. We should be up there. So what we need is money first, owners who understand, and then I think it's our job, us as Blues fans, to get on board and bring as many people as we can with us to the game, fill that stadium, and then I'm doing what I can, we're all doing what we can to sort of connect the club to the area and to that bit of Birmingham and then the bigger bit of Birmingham, and just make sure that people identify with the football team as representatives of something more than just a football team, I think.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, because I mean, I went to the open house, that was what they called it. And just the little projects that they had lined up for the club, it showed that they meant it, you know. And obviously, Rooney's been and gone now, and he's obviously had his time with us, and now Mowbray's the new manager. Still, the ideas that they've got for the club, you know, and the renovations they've given us already, you know, it just shows that it's like you say, like pride and passion, it's profitable, you know, and staying loyal to your customers, you know. And I don't think we've had that as a football club before, and it's kind of a weird feeling for us to have.
I know. We're customers now, not victims, which we've been for like 30 years. And I do think that, you know, there's something good about the American model. I know we can all have our views about that, but the American model of let's treat people as customers and let's give them a good experience, you know, it can be as cynical as you want, but that's what we all want. The main thing about the experience is you've got to win, you know, and that was the first thing I was saying to everybody that I met, is that all of this is absolutely fantastic, but you can have the worst match day experience. If you win 3-0, you're happy. Got to get it right on the pitch. And that's what, I mean, you know, they do get it because they're sports people as well. And you know, to Tom Brady, he completely understands. There's nothing worse than when we lose, as we all know. You know, Saturday night when we've lost is horrible.
There's been too many of those in recent years.
Yeah. And the recent couple of weeks. But maybe I think that maybe the recent couple of weeks is like to our new owners, this is what it's like.
Don't let it keep on happening because it will keep on slipping. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And the sort of points you make there, if you go to a match day game now compared to, you know, a few years back, you're right in that there's so much that's improved. The food's better, even though the programs are looking great these days. As we've said, like the fireworks before the game, it's a rarity as Blues fans because everything off the pitch and surrounding the actual football itself has improved tenfold. Yeah. And bear in mind, they haven't been here years yet. They've been here a couple of months. So just to see that intent, and you only need to listen to Gary Cook or Tom Wagner speak for 10 minutes to know that they know exactly what they're doing and exactly what they're talking about. And as Blues fans, that's just so lovely to see because it's something in recent history we've been deprived of, really.
And it's one that, I mean, I think the way I look at it is that there's no Blues fans who were there because they're glory hunters.
God, you know,
there isn't a single one. There can't be. 99.9% of the fans are there because one of their parents was a Blues fan, and that parent was a Blues fan because their grandparents almost certainly were Blues fans. So what you've got in the Blues support is, I bet that my grandparents and great-grandparents lived within a stone's throw of the parents and grandparents and great-grandparents of most of the people who were there, because they would have come from that particular area, which wasn't big, really. It was crowded, but it wasn't vast. So you've got, you know, your small Ethie Bordsley and all of that South Birmingham stuff. The Birmingham City support, it's almost tribal. It's almost like these are people who have been stuck with this allegiance for 100 years, you know, and we're the next generation. And the thing that I'm really passionate about is, because as I say, I've not made them but all my kids sport Blues, and I just don't want that to be a burden for them. I was living in London, and my oldest son was at school in London, and he was 7, and he came home and he was crying, and I said, what's the matter? He said, I was at school today and somebody said, who do you support? And I said, Birmingham City. And he said, there's no such thing.
Oh, wow.
That's a horrible thing.
we were bad, but we weren't that bad.
But the thing that was like the taster of what could possibly be, like, you know, 2011, the League Cup final,
Oh yeah, it's
and the thing happened that never happens. Like, we go one up, they equalize, so obviously we're gonna get towards extra time. Yeah, of course they're gonna beat us in extra time, and then that happened.
Did you go?
Oh god, yeah, I went with probably about 20 members of my family.
Wow.
I've
got a big family in every sense, like kids, and I'm one of the youngest of seven kids as well, and we're all Blues fans, so, and their kids are all Blues fans, and we all used to go when I was little. But, you know, we're at that match, and the first thing I said to Joe and Ed was like, this doesn't happen. This never happened. And even then, after that, you're expecting them to equalise.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That was by far one of the greatest days I think I'll witness in a long time as a Blues fan.
It's the best day, isn't it?
Well, I'm hoping your generation, you've got lots of them to come.
Fingers crossed, yeah. Can't be any worse than the last few years, can it?
No, I was going to say. Well, this is the thing as well. Since we've come down from the Premier League, we just haven't really had any recent success at all. Not even like an outside the playoff finish. We've just been deprived of any success, which I guess is a good point to segue on to Tony Mowbray and a little bit about Rooney as well. We'll start with Rooney, given that, you know, all that's just happened. Yeah. I mean, it obviously sadly didn't work. Some saying 15 games wasn't enough, deserved a bit more time. I mean, what are your thoughts on the whole Rooney situation?
I think it was a brave decision to act quickly. I just didn't think that it was a fit. I mean, I was all guns blazing to say we've got to support, because we have, you know, once you've appointed the manager, you've got to get behind the manager. There's no point just immediately moaning about it. But Blues are funny. Every supporter thinks their club is unique, and of course every club is unique, but we've got our own sort of way of doing things. And that didn't feel that it was going to work. Just like the Zola thing, you know. Feel as if this was a natural ingrained thing that we would do. And whereas Mowbray, you know, he's funny and is aware of the absurdity of life and all of that, which is what Blues fans are as well, I think. And he's not going to get too big for his boots. He understands football. I think he understands not just Blues fans, but football fans in general, who are not fans of a club like Liverpool or Man City or whatever. Fans of a club like us are there for reasons that defy logic.
Yeah.
You know,
I think you're right to highlight the character of Mowbray there as well, because, you know, someone that can really sort of, you know, have that funny side to him, where we've seen like in press conferences and that, he has a bit of, you know, that character to him. And he's also someone that's got a lot of experience in the game as well. So in terms of sort of, you know, like getting the team sort of back on the same page together, what would you say is the main thing you've got to focus on to try and get that confidence back?
I think confidence is such an important word in football. I was never any good at football. I'm not an expert in football tactics or anything like that. I just want to win desperately, probably more than is acceptable for somebody of my age. I can't lose. I can't stand it, you know. On the day, it's one of those things. And I would hope we're watching players who feel the same. They can't stand to lose. And that's your right. When you look at Ferguson and going back to like Matt Busby and Bill Shankly and people like that, they took over clubs that were middling. People forget that, like Liverpool, Man U, they were okay, you know, they were nothing special. And then these characters came along who would not accept defeat. They wouldn't. So suddenly those two clubs became what they became. And I think, you know, you can be grown up about it, you can try to be grown up about it, but I like the idea that what we should be is not accepting of defeat.
Yeah, it's been a long-standing sort of tradition with the Blues, really. It's like the phrase typical Blues sort of stems from it, doesn't it? Where it's like we've lost the game, we probably should have won it. It's typical Blues to throw it away. But it's like the mentality I think Gary Cook and the board are trying to install now. It's like, well, no, we should want to win those games. We should be bitterly disappointed when we've lost those games.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm all for having a pint after, and in the end it wears off. But in that 90-minute or 100 minutes these days, there's got to be an absolute refusal to accept anything other than victory. Because then once it starts happening, then it becomes a habit, you know, and it's like losing. Once we start doing okay and things start to click. I've been there when we've been good and when we got promoted. And the other problem with that is you get used to that as well. remember on the odd occasions when we've been really good, you sort of get used to it. And we're in the Prem and we're playing Man U, we're playing Arsenal. No, we lost to Arsenal. This is terrible. But you forget to put it in context. But I want us to get into that situation again where you take your kids to the match and they're watching quality against a big opposition. Because why not? We are a big club. We're half of Birmingham. That's a big chunk of people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think even the managerial decisions that have been made in the past, you know, to get rid of Eustace for Rooney and to get rid of Rowett for Zola, each time that decision's made, because prior to those decisions being made, we were picking up results. But these managers have been sacked because maybe the football isn't too pretty, or, you know, we want to play more attacking or no fear footballers, as they worded it. So whilst we were picking up results, the reason for these decisions is we want to be that modern, attacking, fast-paced football club that, yes, are picking up the results, but are also doing it in a way which is entertaining to fans, which I think in some aspect, you know, is been detrimental. I think this is where it's been good that the owners have almost gone back on their initial plan, because it'd be so easy to go out and get a Frank Lampard and try and do the same thing, you know, a big name and try and play that football. But I think, again, where it shows how good our owners are is they've learnt from their mistakes. They're now getting in a manager who's got that experience in a championship, knows it like the back of his hand, has experienced success and might not be the biggest name in the world, but he's a man that will hopefully start to get us results.
Exactly. And you know, the importance of winning, it's obviously, I mean, everybody knows it's self-evident, but for me, the entertainment is winning. And if it's the case, which it actually probably is, if it's the case that playing fast-flowing, entertaining football makes you more likely to win, happy days. You know, and that seems to be the case in the Prem, but we've got to make sure that we know what we're doing in order to just get that result at the end of it.
Yeah, because what would you say that a success would be sort of at the end of the season with Tony Mowbray coming in now with us in 20th place? What would you say would be the success for this season?
Win the FA Cup. I don't know. Probably, and again, it pains me to say, let's accept this, but realistically, it's probably mid-table is fine. You know, if we can start to threaten the playoffs, then fantastic. There's no reason why not. There's plenty of time left, I think. A cup run would be nice. When is the next round?
Round should be in February, I believe, now.
Assuming we beat Hull, obviously.
Yeah, exactly.
The replay first. And then the easy task of Leicester away next up.
Yeah, I would. But yeah, a cup run would be good. I think a cup run would be an interesting thing this season, because if one accepts, which I don't necessarily, but if one accepts we're not going to get into the playoffs, then it would be something to look at. Do you know what I mean? It would be something for us to test ourselves against some bigger clubs and maybe have some fun.
There are quite a few Blues references in Peaky Blinders. Obviously, there is one in the very first episode. Grace is obviously speaking to Harry behind the bar at the Garrison. And so he's always this busy in the daytime. He says, now these lads are off to St Andrews. You know, the Blues are playing.
He says St Andrews, and she says, is that a church?
He says, no, the Blues are playing. You know, they're not going to pray or anything.
Yeah.
And of course, in the last season as well, when they're trying to threaten the ref to throw the game and give a penalty, which he still doesn't. You've worked some realism well into there, actually. I think that's decent on your part. But, I mean, but like, how much influence does Blues have on you writing for Peaky Blinders? Because I imagine the sort of working class feel definitely plays into it.
Yeah, it's absolutely all part of the same thing. I mean, I've said it many times, but the impetus for doing it, for doing Peaky, was stories that my mum and dad told me when I was a kid about their lives when they were kids. And when my mum was 9 years old, she was a bookies runner because betting was illegal. So she lived in Little Green Lanes, and she used to walk down Little Green Lanes with a basket of washing, and people would walk in the other direction and they'd have the name of the horse they were betting on, their code name, and the bet, like sixpence, and they'd drop it in the wash. And my mum would walk down the street taking all these bets. At the end of the street, there was a bookie called Tucker Rice. He was apparently a massive fat bloke, and he had a dog on a chain that was just short enough so you could get.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximise your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Past him. Wow. And she walked past him with a basket of washing and taken her out. And her dad was a gambler. And well, everybody was a gambler then. Mm. And my dad's uncles were the Sheldons. For some reason, the BBC wouldn't let me call them Sheldons. They said, you've got to change your name. As if these gangsters from the 1920s was going to get offended and sue us.
Defamation, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. How dare you? They were, as I say, my dad's uncles. And no matter what you may read that people say about, oh, there were no Peaky Blinders after 1900 and stuff, in Small Heath and Bordesley, they were known as the Peaky Blinders.
Mm.
And my dad told a story where his dad, all blues fans, by the way, my granddad was at the Somme and was shot with a dum-dum bullet, which is illegal now, but it's a bullet that explodes inside. So he had bits of shrapnel in his body until 1968. He used to cut our hair when we were kids, so I remember him, and he was always in pain. But anyway, that's another story. But he was a First World War veteran, and he one time said to my dad, take this message to your uncles, the Sheldons. My dad was terrified, so he's barefoot, my dad, running down. They were in Sandy Lane off Watery Lane. And he goes to where they live and knocks on the door. And he said, the door opened. There's this waft of cigarette smoke, whiskey and beer. And he looks in and there's a round table covered in coins because they've taken all the bets. And he said, there's about seven blokes sitting around immaculately dressed, like the caps and the and everything, boots are shining. And they're drinking whiskey out of jam jars because they wouldn't spend any of that money on something like glasses, do you know what I mean?
Not cut. Amazing, that is.
And, that story was the thing that made me want to do it. Because obviously the blokes were all veterans from the First World War, so they were all pretty screwed up from experiences that they had, but wouldn't let on.
Yeah.
Would never show that emotion, would never talk about it. My granddad never talked about it. And you got these men, and in an age where it's sort of unfashionable, that sort of thing that we're talking about. But, you know, here are these men who are like statues, drinking, running a gambling organisation. I just thought, this is in Brum, you know, this is absolutely part of Birmingham history that never gets told. And so I just thought, that is a drama. It's like a Western, you know.
It is very much like a Western, yeah. Actually.
And what I wanted to do is, like, when my parents witnessed all of this, they're little kids, you know, and the garrison door opens, and the garrison is like this theatre, this cathedral for them. So it's a myth for them. And then they tell me, and I'm a kid when they tell me, so it's doubly mythologized. And when I went to do it, I thought, what I don't want to do is, isn't it a shame for these poor working class people? You know, didn't they have a terrible time? Wasn't it awful? Sod that, you know, the people were having a laugh. And that was most of the stories about the laughter and you know, drinking and fighting and all that stuff. It's glamorous stuff. So I wanted to make it the mythology of Birmingham, and why not? And you have to get over that. Well, I can't make this glamorous because it's Birmingham. Well, you can.
Yeah.
No reason why not. It's the same as Chicago or Philadelphia or anywhere else, you know.
I think because when I was doing my research for you into this podcast, I remember you said that story to Talk Radio. I think it was before the release of the fourth series back in 2017. I just remember thinking, though, that that is just Peaky Blinders, like, to a T. Like, you can see all the imagery in that room. It's in the first, in the very first series, when they're still living in the near the Garrison Lane pub.
That
front room is so small because, you know, it's sort of what they can, that they had at the time. But, like, I mean, the music that you use in it as well, like, you use a lot of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Obviously, that's, like, you know, the theme tune is obviously Red Right Hand and everything. But, like, I mean, it's weird to use modern music, well, modern music in a way, but, like, it makes the scenery better. It makes the show feel more attractive to a more of a modern audience.
Well, with the first series, it was when it was being cut together, we got quite a good group of editors working on it, post-production people, and they used to put modern tracks to it when they were editing to get the rhythm, and it just worked so well. And so I just thought, well, let's do that then. And what's been great about it is that after probably series two, a lot of music artists liked the show, and they were offering us their music for less than BBC rates, you know, and so we were spoiled for choice because we got a really good dedicated group of really cool music artists who they were just really good, and so we were able to use the music. And the more it happened, and then Snoop Dogg said, this was, I think, series four, Snoop Dogg came to England, and his agent said that he wanted to meet me because he was a big Peaky fan. So we met in St. Martin's Lane Hotel. He couldn't go to the bar, so go to his room, and he's building this thing that he's going to smoke. It's like this big, and I'm drinking beer, and he's just talking about his life and how, and this is the weird thing, he saw in Peaky Blinders echoes of how he got involved in gang culture. And you think, well, how can that be? So this is South Central LA, and this is Birmingham in the 20s. But there's something, and, you know, some shows are lucky, and I think Peaky is lucky, is that there's something about it that seems to resonate with a lot of people, and music artists seem to be prominent amongst them.
It seems like a lot of Peaky Blinders is not only for yourself, but other people as well, based off sort of real life experiences, or can somewhat relate to it. And that seems crazy, given the amount of, like, violence and gang culture we see in the show. So is a lot of what was written, obviously not all of it, but are parts of it based off real life experiences then? Is a lot of it research? What's the show sort of centered around, I guess?
The characters are based on real people, like Charlie Strong. When I was, my dad was a farrier, a blacksmith, so he used to shoe horses, and he had a mobile forge. And when I was a kid, we'd wake up in the morning, my dad would say, do you want to go to school or do you want to come with me? And so some of us would get in the van and we'd go out to these places where he's shoeing horses. And there was a lot of quite, you know, respectable riding stables and stuff. But he also used to go to a lot of scrap metal yards, where there's a lot of Romani people. And Charlie Strong was one of me, he was in Nietzsche's, and he, there was a bloke called Curly who worked with him, who was my, I found out later, was my great uncle.
Oh, wow.
and they were just the most amazing people. So imagine you're a kid and you're not going to school, and you're driving into the big metal doors open, and you're driving to this scrap metal yard in Nietzsche's, and there's a fire going, and somebody's cooking bacon and egg on it, and there's all these interesting characters and stuff. And you go in there and the horses are there, and your dad starts shit. I used to turn the handle on the forge to get the coal hot, and they were just such a laugh. Like, I used this line in the series where I said to my dad once, I said, is this stuff stolen? And my dad said, no. He said, Charlie finds things just before they're lost.
That is a brilliant line. That is fantastic.
But they were all like that. They were hilarious. And, you know, really, this would be the late 60s, early 70s. So I think I glimpsed the end of a sort of Victorian Birmingham. Where there were still horses and carts and things. And that's how I shaped the series. So I put Charlie Strong in it, I put Curly in it. Polly was my dad's auntie. And so I grew up with stories about Aunt Polly, who was, like, really good with her fists and all. So it's not so much events, because you'd run out of events quite quickly, but it's more the characters and who they are and how they were. And something about the way men were as well, especially.
Just following on from, like, Zach's question about sort of, you know, like, research and everything, you say there about sort of, you know, having those ideas to start off with and then kind of branching off. How much of, you know, do you have to balance between fiction and also what happens in real life too?
I mean, you've got to go for fiction. You've got to tell a story that's entertaining. So I will absolutely follow a drama story in it and have it good and bad, and bad character becomes good, or good character becomes bad, and all that stuff that is hopefully interesting. Any research I did, I used to look at old copies of the Birmingham Mail, and I recommend that to anybody rather than reading the history book, because history books, I think and it's their job, so I wouldn't know, but I think they tend to take events and then look at them as if what eventually happened was inevitable. So that happened, that happened, that happened, so obviously therefore that would happen. But I don't think history is like that. It's chaos, you know. We all know real life is chaotic. Mm. And if you read that, the Birmingham Mail from the 1920s, things like, I remember my dad telling me about this. He said, because he was quite left-wing when he was young. Not when he was older, but when he was young. And he said that he'd be in the ball ring and some bloke would put a box down and he'd stand on the box and he'd start talking about communism and revolution. Mm. And he said the police would come, take him to Steelhouse Lane, and he'd never be seen again.
Wow.
And it's like, wow. And then, you know, you think, well, maybe he's misremembered. But then I looked at the Birmingham Mail, and there's a case, some person arrested in the ballroom for sedition for what he was saying. And he was given like 10 years.
Gosh.
I know. And that's not in the history book. And then, you know, you read about, oh, it was all fine. We were in each other's houses and borrowing cups of sugar. And in the papers, there's all these armed robberies and things. And actually, the best bit of research, I can't remember where it came from, but it was police records of a kid who I think was 10 years old who was arrested. And he was arrested because his mother reported him. And what had happened was his mother had given this kid like sixpence or whatever to go and get food for the family. And he came back with a top hat and a coconut.
Wow.
Generous, sir.
It's not much help.
His mom is like, what are you doing? Obviously, she's skinned. They're all skinned. So she's got this top hat and this coconut. And so she calls the police.
Oh, it is amazing.
It's a police report. The boy, you know, bought a top hat and a coconut.
Wow.
Stuff like that. I mean, that's where reality is so much more interesting than anything that anybody like me can make up, you know.
Mm.
Yeah, and I guess you forget a lot of these things. It wasn't that long ago. We're talking 100 years ago, you know. It's not, you know, 1652. Only 100 years ago. I mean, in terms of the show and everything, let's talk, I guess, a little bit about the characters and all that. Tommy Shelby, he's obviously the main character in the show, but one of the biggest characters in TV now. Did you expect him as a character and, I guess, the show as a whole to become quite as big as it's become?
Absolutely not, no. And it continues to be astonishing to me that, you know, I get people sending me photos from Buenos Aires and from China and from all, and they walk into a bar and there's Tommy Shelby and Arthur and Polly and all on the wall. I don't know why or how it's resonated with so many people. America, I mean, the US, it's huge, and Netflix have just released some figures about viewing figures, which are just, we knew it was good, but we didn't know exactly. It's just like there's a lot of people out there watching it. And no, certainly didn't expect it to be like that. And you're right, Tommy Shelby has become this real sort of iconic.
Yeah.
I've heard a few stories regarding obviously Cillian Murphy and how he got the voice for Tommy Shelby. How did you come up with that kind of accent for him? How did he develop that accent?
We being me and my mates who go to the match and two of my brothers, we took him to the Garrison pub and he bought a tape recorder. I think it was a cassette recorder. That's how long ago it was. He brings a cassette recorder. And the Garrison was being the Garrison. The landlord was asleep on the bar.
Like how on the bar? Like actually on the bar? Actually
on the bar, yeah.
Oh my God.
It was the last days of Roman. It was the last days of the Garrison when it was really, really, really weird. And we went in there. So we're all there. We've got photos of it as well. There's probably about 10 of us all together. And what he was doing is recording people talking to get the accent. And so we're all there talking, getting drunk and stuff. And it was a Royal Antwerp. It was a pre-season friendly against, I think it was Royal Antwerp. So we were meant to all go to the match. We didn't get to the match in him. And we're all in the pub talking, and then we start singing and all this sort of stuff. Some of my mates have friends who do things that are not necessarily legal. So occasionally they'd go, turn the tape off, and tell you the story. And Gillian took the tape home with him and just listened to it over and over again. And what I think he got is, and the first series, we had all sorts of problems about the accent, and understandably, Brummies are saying that the accents are terrible. It's just really difficult to do for an actor. It's that I think Brummy and Geordie are really tricky. And the problem was we had a voice coach, and what was happening was that the actors were doing their lines and the voice coach would go, no, don't say that. And it was just getting in the way of the whole thing. So in the end, I said, let's just get rid of the voice coach. Let's worry about the accent. It's not going to be perfect, but let's do the performance first. And then, and you know, the defence that you put up is, I remember my grandparents' accent was very different to mine. Accents even. It was very different. So who knows what they sound like and all of that. But, you know, some of those accents did grind away a bit. But Killian had got, I think, from meeting people, the speed of it. For some reason, when people have been Brummy, they slow down. I don't know why. And if you go at it fast, which he did, just keep doing it, then I think, you know, that's how you get it. But it is a very difficult accent.
What was Killian like to work with then? Because he's obviously a massive name now. So what was he like?
He's... still is, was then, and hopefully always will be, just the best bloke. He really is. He's absolutely, and I'm not just saying that, he leads the line in terms of the actors. You know what I mean? The filming is hard work. And it's a lot of time and people get exhausted and things. It's quite an intense thing to be on a set for like 12 weeks and you're all working together. So it's ups and downs. But we've been really lucky with the people we've got. Because it's been successful, we've lost actors who have been offered other stuff and there's nothing we could do about it, because what we didn't do is what the Americans do, which is tie everybody into a contract that keeps them there for 10 years. So I've had to, you know, write the death of characters really want to write because they'd got another job.
Well, John was the big one, I think, in the end of season 3 or start of season 4.
I think that was right at the start, wasn't it, where like literally you're like bang straight into the series.
It's a great way to start. Happens.
And you're like,
It actually sometimes it's a good thing because it makes you do something that you wouldn't want to do, so it's unexpected and everybody goes, oh my god.
Yeah, it's a complete twist. Like I remember watching it just thinking like, oh my word, like what's happening here? Chuck straight into it.
And in terms of the way Peaky Blinders rounded up, we obviously saw the death of Michael, and then you got a lot of praise for the way it was all rounded up as a series, a really nice ending. I guess my first question to that is, are you happy with how Peaky Blinders ended and how it was wrapped up? And I guess, that was my follow-up. Is there still more?
Yeah. Well, we're doing the film. So we're shooting that this year. And that will, for me, that will be the end of this era. And then the door is open to do, you know, subsequent with different cast and it'd be a different era, so it would be into the 50s.
I see, yeah.
To carry the story on, you know, as long as people want it,
I see that, yeah,
definitely.
Well, I think that is pretty much all we've got time for, actually. But yeah, Stephen, honestly, thank you so much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Let's hope that. This is for Tony Mowbray, glass of champagne.
Yeah. I've only got a glass of water, so I'll be So, yeah, thank you for listening to this episode of the Blues Focus podcast. We will be back very soon. Thank you again, Stephen. And keep right on.
Keep on.
Keep on.
Got the Blue Bulls.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates are round, you've got your McNugget share box ready to go, your mates are already booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
And there it is. That's as good as it gets on this stage. Nissan Townstar EV strikes again. It's an unstoppable van. Unstoppable!
Look, just fantastic. You can actually see the ProPilot technology in action. Effortless parallel parking.
It moves with all the confidence that comes with a 5-year warranty.
And with a bench full of all-star van experts, there's real strength in depth here.
That's all-star quality.
Search Nissan Townstar EV and visit your local all-star van centre to see for yourself.
Terms and conditions apply. 5 years or 100,000 miles, whichever comes first.
ProPilot is an advanced driver assist technology. Driver's responsibility to stay alert, drive safely, and control vehicle at all times.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.